This is Jazz Nightly from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. And during the Cold War, beginning in 1956, a few of the most important musicians in jazz were sent abroad by the U.S. State Department as cultural ambassadors. Dizzy Gillespie, Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, Benny Goodman, and Dave Brubeck traveled the globe promoting America as a country of freedom and tolerance. While back home, the nation was struggling with racist policies as the civil rights movement was underway. A new documentary titled The Jazz Ambassadors tells this story. It airs on SDPB-TV Friday evening at 9 Central, 8 Mountain. The director-writer is Hugo Barkley, and he's with me on the line from Washington, D.C. And Hugo, thanks for joining us on Jazz Nightly.
Thanks very much for having me, Carl.
Were you familiar with this story of jazz musicians being used as cultural ambassadors during the Cold War before you started working on the film?
Well, the way I came into contact with it was that I had been working in Ghana around their independence celebrations, the 50th anniversary of independence celebrations, and I saw this amazing footage of Louis Armstrong playing a concert for Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, who would be the liberator of Ghana in the 50s. And that I was a jazz fan, and I was just really intrigued how he ended up in the Gold Coast, which would become Ghana in the 50s. And that led me to do more investigation, and I read a book by Penny Von Eschen called Satchmo Blows Up the World. And then I thought, I wonder who's made a film about this. And when it turned out that no one had made a film about it, I thought maybe I could. And that was the beginning of a long journey almost 10 years ago.
Set the stage for us here. Take us back to the 1950s. How did this idea of sending jazz musicians abroad by the U.S. State Department as cultural ambassadors, how did that begin? Was there someone who first came up with this idea?
Yeah, I think that's one of the real starting points of the film for me, was like, how did this happen? And why did it happen? It seemed such a great idea on the one hand, and then on the other hand, there's this element of kind of paradox of asking African-American musicians to do propaganda for the United States right at the height of the civil rights conflict. So there seem to be so many interesting questions to ask. And I guess the place which I've arrived at and the description that we have in the film is that there's no one decision maker. There was no kind of master plan to make this happen. But there were a few really important driving forces. One of them was a program on Voice of America radio station hosted by Willis Conover, called Music USA, that started in 1955. And the State Department was just amazed because they received thousands of fan letters from around the world. And they sort of thought to themselves, wow, this music is really, really popular. Incredible. And at the same time, here in Washington, where I am currently, the U.S. Congressman, Adam Clayton Powell Jr., was dissatisfied with the way America was engaging with non-white countries. He felt that rather than take a very suspicious and kind of defensive stance against countries like India, African countries, Asian countries, which America had been doing up until that point, feeling that they may be turning communist, that America should be more positive in its engagement. And he kind of single-handedly defied American foreign policy edicts not to engage directly with these countries, and showed American foreign policy officials how much there was to be gained by having a positive interaction with non-white countries. And so he, through a series of actions, which we explain in the film, kind of changes opinions in Washington right at that crucial moment in 1955, and helps to build a consensus for the first jazz ambassador's mission, which is him convincing Dizzy Gillespie, his old friend from Harlem, that he should go on the road and represent America. And that's really where the genesis of a few kind of concurrent storylines come together to form that first 1956 tour.
Now, the orchestra that Dizzy Gillespie took overseas, took to Turkey, Iran, Pakistan, Syria, and Greece, this was a band that was multiracial. There was a female trombonist, Melba Liston, in the band. People of different faiths. Was that a part of the strategy as well, that you had an orchestra, that a band that represented a cross-section of Americans?
Absolutely. I think the State Department was very keen to show the kind of pluralistic nature of American society. I think from a racial point of view, they liked the fact that Dizzy was African-American, that he was the band leader, and that he had white members of his band, and also, you know, there was a mix of women and men, of different religious pursuits, as you say. So I think there was this sense, and it was certainly something that the radio host, Willis Conover, advertised on his radio show, that jazz was an inherently democratic, thereby American, form of music, that you had a few rules that you all agreed upon, and that then once you'd agreed upon those rules, everybody was free to express themselves and to do what they wanted to do. And so, you know, looking back on it now, it's kind of funny, but at the time, there's this very explicit idea that jazz is a quintessentially democratic form of music, and the Dizzy Gillespie Orchestra really epitomizes that. One of the ironies about that particular tour is that it was designed to address the racial issues that confronted America on the international stage at that time. But one of the things that really outraged people in the Middle East when they showed up to play was the integration of men and women on stage, which I think in a number of countries was far more perturbing than the fact that there were black and white musicians playing together. So in some ways, you never know quite what's going to happen when the plan hits the real world. But the band was very successful and I think benefited from this great mix of people and different elements of society that figured in that band.
What I was surprised to learn in watching this film, Jazz Ambassadors, is that after the first tour with Dizzy Gillespie, when he got back home, there was some controversy about this from some members of Congress, some politicians who thought, well, why are we spending all this money sending jazz musicians overseas?
That's right. There's a constant push and pull in U.S. foreign policy in the late 50s and in the 60s as to how to deal with the civil rights movement on an international stage. And by and large, I think you can say that the foreign policy makers, the people working at the State Department, wanted to tell the world that America's racial problems were going to take care of themselves. If you just give us a bit of time, we're going to work all this stuff out. And eventually we'll reach a place of improved racial conditions and the fixing of racial inequality within the United States. That was the image that they wanted to sell the rest of the world. That, of course, went down very badly with Southern segregationists who said, hold on a second, there's nothing inevitable about racial, you know, the end of racial discrimination in this country. In fact, as the civil rights movement heated up, the violence in defense of the segregationist status quo became more and more outrageous and barbaric. So as these tours got going and U.S. State Department officials realized how powerful they were as a tool of diplomacy, there was also a reaction from the forces of segregation in the U.S. government who said, hold on a second, you're selling something that there's no real reason to believe is going to become an inevitable fact. That how can you do this when we're still involved in a discussion? So I think you can really see the criticism of Dizzy Gillespie's tour in Congress and the arguments over the funding of that within this ongoing discussion of racial violence, racial tension, and how that could be explained to the outside world. But I also think that the State Department officials, once Dizzy got back, had seen how powerful this tool was and they were going to use it. So it didn't really matter. But it was obviously very dispiriting to many of the musicians who felt like they'd done a great thing for their country and they were criticized in the press and by members of their own government. And as Charlie Persip, the drummer, says in the documentary, that was really very personally disappointing and painful for them.
This is South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. My guest is Hugo Barkley, writer and director of the documentary film Jazz Ambassadors. It airs on SDPB-TV Friday night at 9 Central, 8 Mountain. And Hugo, the attitude of the musicians themselves, people like Dizzy Gillespie and Louis Armstrong, is they didn't sugarcoat anything when they went overseas. They represented America as it was.
That's exactly right. And I think that for me, that was once I'd found out about the story, I then wanted to understand how each of the, as a filmmaker, I'm saying now, as someone sort of thinking about how to tell this story on screen, I wanted to understand how each of the musicians who had agreed to go on one of these Jazz Ambassadors tours, how they dealt with the paradox which seemed to be right at the very heart of their construction, which was representing America, representing their patriotism in the Cold War, but also representing a feeling of outrage at the discrimination that African Americans suffered on a daily basis. And they particularly felt as touring musicians in the South and had to deal with very frequently. So this cut very close to home. And so I wanted to understand that. And I thought in the making of this film, the only way to truly understand that was to hear it in the musician's own words. So one of the big efforts that we undertook in this film was to find really any and every instance where these musicians spoke about their feelings regarding that paradox, whether that was in radio interviews or in filmed interviews or even writing in their memoirs or in discussions with other people. So we've tried in the film as much as possible to let them answer that question. And for me, that's the heart of the film. And I think what's so powerful is that each of these musicians, they were able to answer it both through their music, but also through a kind of political strength that they had, because they were so famous and they had such clear ideas about what they wanted to say. So you see Dizzy Gillespie speaking his mind very clearly and saying, I'm absolutely refusing to apologize for the racist policies of America. You see Louis Armstrong canceling his tour of the Soviet Union in 1957 over the Little Rock incident and Eisenhower's refusal to send troops into Little Rock in September. And so you see a number of ways in which they're able to push back on these issues and to carve out a very honest position, which I'm not sure that the State Department really understood that they were going to give the musicians when they designed this policy, but ultimately ended up being very effective.
What was the reception of Dizzy Gillespie, Louis Armstrong, and the others when they were overseas? My understanding is that they were roundly cheered, and people loved getting to meet them and to hear this music that for many of these countries, this was very unusual music.
That's absolutely right. I think it was an eye-opening experience, I would say, on both sides. On the one hand, jazz audiences who had maybe been listening to Voice of America and had heard a lot of modern jazz. I mean, jazz had an interesting history internationally dating back to the 1920s, but who knew were very knowledgeable about jazz, and what they had a hunger to hear live jazz musicians. And that was particularly true in Behind the Iron Curtain, Polish audiences and Soviet audiences who had not had the opportunity to see live jazz musicians, but also in other parts of the world, in India, in Pakistan, Iraq, Iran, people were very eager to learn more about the music. There were some places, I think Dizzy said, he played a few places in Duke Ellington in Pakistan as well, where audiences really didn't know how to understand the music. But I think at the end of concerts, they'd found a great way of communicating. So in general, that was a great source of pleasure. On the other side, for the musicians themselves, I think sometimes you could see how amazed they were by the popularity that they encountered in countries that they never thought that they had an audience. So a piece of interview that really sticks with me is Louis Armstrong coming back from Africa in 1961. And you can just see in his face and in his voice how moved he is by the response that he's had to his concerts there. And I think that was a real eye-opener for him that, you know, yes, he knew how popular he was in the United States and maybe in Europe too, but he was really a global figure, and these tours really, I think, reinforced that. And of course, they also exposed musicians like Brubeck and Ellington and Armstrong to new music from the country that they were visiting. So it's this wonderful moment of exchange where the information goes both ways, and I think everybody emerges the richer for it.
Oh, yeah, you think of Dave Brubeck. He comes back home and he writes Blue Rondo a la Turk, and Duke Ellington has the Far East Suite. So this really was a wonderful opportunity for everyone involved. As you mentioned, it went both ways.
Absolutely, and it's very important to remember something that Dave Brubeck's son, Darius, says in the film, which is that this is before the YouTube era. I mean, you couldn't Google everything and just hear it right away. So to have a chance to go to, I don't know, Izmir in Turkey and hear street musicians, or to go to Isfahan in southern Iran, I believe, and hear the music and the bird song and the sounds there for Duke Ellington. These were not easy experiences to have, and they really absorbed them, being the fantastic composers and musicians that they were. They had a chance to absorb those and feed them into their own political repertoire, and I think jazz has changed forever because of that. You see new musical palettes, new musical time signatures entering into the mainstream, and there's no better example than Time Out, which would go on to be, you know, the Dave Brubeck song, which would go on to be one of the best-selling jazz records of all time. And I don't think we would have had that if it hadn't been for the Jazz Ambassadors tours.
Now, Duke Ellington in 1963 was in the Middle East, in India, Turkey, other countries. And it was during his tour that JFK was assassinated in Texas. And while Ellington wanted to keep going, the State Department brought his band back home. Why was that?
What I was told during my interviews was that there were a number of State Department tours on the road at that time. There was a ballet tour, I think, in Russia, possibly. And the Ellington Band was the one that was brought home, whereas other tours were left on the road. And I think that probably speaks, and Robert O'Mealy, the jazz critic and writer, says so in the film, that speaks to this idea that jazz was a sort of lowbrow entertainment, or at least in the eyes of the State Department planners, they didn't really understand quite how majestic and impactful the music was. So they thought, in a time of national mourning, you really wouldn't want people hopping around on stage having a great time. You should be much more somber. Well, Duke Ellington had a completely different approach to his music, and he spent, I think, some time right after he heard of the assassination composing funereal music, and I think feeling musically what had happened, the magnitude of that. And he was very willing to perform that music. And I think it's probably very sad that the State Department officials at the very end of that long history of sending all these great bands didn't utilize them when they may have been most needed. So that's a kind of bittersweet end to the Ellington tour, and in a way to the whole epoch of the great multi-leg, big band Jazz Ambassadors tours, which kind of change in the wake of that curtailed Ellington tour. They become a bit smaller. They become a bit more focused on particular regions or particular countries. And the kind of heyday of the tours is over with that Ellington tour.
Do you think, Hugo Barclay, that the U.S. should do something like this now, send jazz musicians and maybe other musicians abroad as cultural ambassadors, when you look back at the positive impact that this had back in the late 50s and early 60s?
That's an interesting question. And I actually was having lunch today with several people from the cultural presentation section of the State Department, and I think they do more than I had actually known. They wanted to tell me some of the stuff that they're doing, precisely because I think the film raises questions like this. What they do today, I believe, is on a slightly smaller scale, in the sense that they're not sending the most famous musicians out there. They're sending, you know, musicians who may be on a different stage in their career or haven't reached that kind of fame, and they're bringing other musicians to the United States. So I think it does continue to exist. It's maybe not as well publicized as it could be, and I'm not sure that we've all heard about it to the same extent that people would have heard about this in the 1950s. But I do think that, you know, in moments of national crisis and the civil rights era and the Cold War, certainly are moments of national crisis, and maybe we're heading towards some similar moments of national difficulty or international difficulty with some of the things that are happening today. I do think that culture can play a really healing and galvanizing role in a kind of public discourse. And maybe that's the question to ask. Is there a moment when we can rally around certain cultural signposts, certain cultural signifiers, and sort of stress our unity rather than our division? And I guess that's what I would hope for, that in these difficult times, one thing we can learn from the Jazz Ambassadors program and from looking at that again today is just how much we have to learn from our great creators and our great musicians, and what a strength they can be on a national and an international level.
Hugo Barclay is the writer and director of the new documentary, The Jazz Ambassadors. It airs on SDPB-TV Friday evening at 9 Central, 8 Mountain. And Hugo, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us on Jazz Nightly.
Thank you, Carl. It's been a real pleasure.